All right, everybody. So today we have a special podcast. This is actually my 100th podcast since starting the Brains and Games podcast about almost 2 years ago. Seems pretty crazy. And of course, I wanted to bring Dr. Eric Helms on. How you doing, man?
I am honored to be on for the 100th episode, man.
Yeah, and so part of the reason why, I mean, when I first started this, you were either the first or one of the first people I reached out to. And for people who aren't familiar, basically what happened was I was actually watching Steve Hall's podcast. And I had thought, you know, I really like this guy, Scott Stevenson. I followed him for a long time. I followed Eric. And I was like, you know, you should just get these guys together. And then after a while, I just thought, I'm just going to do this myself. And, it turned into a big project. And it's been a lot of fun, more work than I originally expected. But it's been great. I did eventually get you guys on about a year ago now, which was also great. And so I kind of wanted to get you back on. And it's also funny because, like, as I'm watching other podcasts or doing things in the industry, I'll have questions come to mind. And one of the coolest things about having a podcast is it just kind of gives you access to people for more than just maybe like an Instagram question or something. You know, I was definitely very grateful that when we first talked about 2 years ago, you had actually sent me a voice message on Facebook. And at the time, like, that was awesome. You know, it was about 3 minutes and just was like, oh man, Eric Helms is talking to me there. But now to be able to have several hour long conversations is great. And I'll occasionally just kind of write down things as I'm thinking about them. And once I get to, you know, X number of questions, I'll just bring that person on and then we can really chat about it. And that's been one of the coolest things about the podcast is really getting to know some of these people.
Yeah, that's with the 3DMJ podcast and with Iron Culture, they both serve to keep us connected. They're great opportunities for people to actually just talk, you know.
Yeah.
And so there are these sneaky ways of getting the opportunity to be connected with other people in the industry with similar interests back or different backgrounds, similar interests. So, yeah, I totally know what you're talking about, man.
Yeah. And it's, you know, one of the other reasons I reached out was because I think having now done this for 2 years, as far as like the podcast format and getting to talk to a lot of people, it is really interesting. You get different perspectives than I think you would, because I mean, I've been watching the fitness stuff for, I mean, really almost my entire time lifting. So like 14, 15 years, at least from the forums and then YouTube and all of that. But still, I would say you just get a different perspective when talking to people or meeting up with people. And there are people who are exactly as I expected them to be. And there are people who are quite a bit different than I expected them to be. And it's interesting to see that side. Something I've found with you and that me and Abel Chabaya had talked about quite a bit is just that I think I really respect your love for this endeavor. And I know that there were times that you've, you know, maybe been more like hypercritical of yourself or that you had different goals, but something that I really respect, it actually makes me happy to see your Instagram, because there are a lot of people that, you know, I don't want to say they have the wrong reason for doing it, but you have clearly developed a love for the process. And now, like, you're going into weightlifting and you've talked about strongman, and you clearly have this like love of the iron game that you've cultivated and that you get out there. And, you know, we were talking about there's, you know, another, I guess, influencer, or whatever you want to call it, who maybe has a bigger following out there. But what Abel said was he's like the Kim Kardashian of the fitness industry now, where it's like, it's fine, you know, it probably pays well, but it's just, I think for a lot of us, like, that's not really what we're looking at. And we like that we have somebody like you that can really, you know, because it's for you, it's full time, right? So as much as I might love it, it's hard to compare when I have another job 45 hours a week. So I think it's just you're a nice beacon for some people of like what this can be. And I think that's cool to see.
Well, that's just really cool to hear. It makes me feel very acknowledged. And yeah, so thank you, man. And that is, it's always good to get that kind of feedback, because that's the intention. You know, like, I have worked very hard to become more process oriented from the point when I realized that not being process oriented was a threat to me continuing to do the thing that I really, really enjoy. And that was a very positive perspective shift in my life. So a large part of what I try to do is to make that and talk about it, make that an avenue, a pathway, something, a thing that people can see as like, oh, that's an option. Or at least maybe I could think about thinking that way.
Sure.
So yeah, that's really cool, man. And I'm glad to hear that I don't fall into the category of Kim Kardashian. So
so this is a not really a lifting question, more of a psychology question, but they'll say how sometimes actors will almost start to become like the roles that they're playing. And it's funny because obviously people do compare you to Chris Evans being Captain America. And I'd recently gone back and watched him in the original Fantastic Four, and it's a completely different character, right? He's kind of like the playboy character and everything. And then obviously he's kind of like the goody two shoes guy as Captain America. And I wonder if that's kind of like paved how he acts. And with somebody who actually comparing you to Captain America and now talking about you as like really good guy in the industry and this persona that I've mentioned, do you think that that's played into how you've developed as well, almost wanting to fulfill that persona?
I think it has. And I think it's been something that's happened for a fair amount of time before I got the Captain America comparison. And a large part of that is that all of my endeavors in the fitness industry are collaborative. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with doing it on your own, but I am actually really glad looking back that 3D Muscle Journey was the first thing I did. And I started that with, my 3 and eventual 4 partners and our extended team. Now, the pyramid books that I wrote with Andy and Andrea, Mass is with Greg and Eric and Lindsay, and Mike. And, each one of the things I do, Iron Culture with Omar, when I speak on behalf of any of the ventures or missions or organizations that I'm part of, like AET, I'm representing something bigger than myself. I'm representing our mission statement. And I think that helps me hold myself accountable to how do I want to represent that? Is everyone going to be comfortable with me saying that? And, believe it or not, some of our earliest meetings that we had with 3DMJ, which is around like our old like dinner dining table in our house in Sacramento way back in the day, when there was negative feedback or things that made my team uncomfortable, it was because I was moving too quickly or making moves unilaterally. And there's nothing like disappointing or letting down people you love or care about, especially kind of like a surrogate father figures like a Jeff Alberts or Brad Loomis to me. Right. Than to make you more self-aware and modify your behavior. So, and especially, I think that coincided because it was like 2009 we started. Facebook blew up shortly after that. And it's, how social media is. It gives you an opportunity to say stuff, not to someone else's face, when you're triggered with nothing to really stop you from just making your fingers turn you into a right. D-bag,
Right.
So, and the way the internet used to be was that people, and it still is this way to some degree, but it's much more ubiquitous now, but people would be like, oh, in the real world, I'll be this person, but I'll go on the internet to troll.
Yeah.
And I think in 2020 now that like social media is everywhere so much, there's less of that whole, like, whatever, it's internet, it's not serious.
Right.
That attitude just died down. But I very quickly was like, you know what? I actually need to be more on point, more serious, check myself, take a second, breathe before I post, think about what I want to say and who I'm representing on the internet, because there's no context. Someone can just randomly read it who's not part of the conversation. There's no tone. There's no nonverbal cues. And it's more likely when I'm speaking without all of that to an audience of thousands that I can be misinterpreted, unintentionally offensive, or a joke could be taken the wrong way. But anyone who knows me in person or on podcasts will see that I'm probably a little more sarcastic, a little more willing to make jokes because I can get those things across. But so I think those are two different things that influence me to, I guess, play into that role, is that I see I'm holding the mantle for a lot of people. There's a lot of, I wouldn't say pressure, but there's a lot of responsibility for me to represent the organizations and teams and people that I represent. And I also know that being a online business person, it's easy to step in it, and I don't want to be that guy.
So. Yeah, totally makes sense. So you're catching me today not only for the 100th podcast, but this is also the last day of my diet that has been too long. So I'm probably the lightest I've been in quite a while. I've been dieting for about 5 months, and I'm very much feeling it. doing like the whole thing. I'm gonna be taking pictures. I shaved, so I'm a very hairy person. So shaved everything. Took me like an hour and a half with the buzzer I have, whole process. And it's actually interesting. So I want to get your feedback on this. I might actually send you like a little Excel of like my weight and my average calories. But it's one of those situations where when I run into issues, as I routinely do when I diet, because I don't know if I just have an unusual stress response or what goes on there. But I will have, you know, when I'm bulking up, I'll have like a weekly log, and I'll have, you know, a sentence or two of what happened this week. And when dieting, there's all these notes because it's never going as I want it to. And I seem to actually, I had you and Eric Trexler on back in, I think, March or so, the start of my cut. And even then, I was saying how I was holding several pounds of water. I did a diet break, and then it kind of came off. So recently, what kind of happened, I guess I'll just like tell the story here, is I had, just to experiment, I don't recommend it, I had done about a month of carnivore diet. I just wanted to see what would happen. I got blood work done. It's just interesting to me. A few of the things I've done this cut, I would not recommend to clients, but just again, I like to experiment. And so I was losing weight quite well with it, and I looked better almost daily. What I did not factor in was how much food bulk I would be losing, you know, from just eating the meat compared to all these fibrous vegetables. So when I had then gone off carnivore and added a bunch of vegetables, I found that even though I was in the same calories pretty much, I was gaining weight. And so I had an idea in my mind of this many weeks left of dieting. And now I've got 2 weeks of stressful dieting and gaining weight. So I did something again. This is the other thing I wouldn't recommend, is it's basically a crash diet to the end of my, you know, weight goal and body fat goal. And Abel and I again were chatting and saying how you had at times had to get extremely low calories for your contest. Am I correct that you had some days as low as like 1200?
Yeah, and but the weeks were on average around like 14 to 16 when it was that
Okay.
low, because I had refeeds.
Yeah, and
But
I'm glad
yeah.
you point that out, because I think something I said to Abel was that a lot of people, when they say how low they diet, they speak as if their lowest day was what they're dieting on. That's not really like completely representative. So I'm glad you made that caveat there. So for me, I basically did a rapid fat loss for 2 weeks, and I did 2 weeks at 1,000 calories, which I've never done before. Again, I just keep saying it, but I again don't recommend it. I just wanted to see, you know, how quickly I could gain or lose weight. What I found, to my surprise, that I'm sure almost anybody would say, you're not tracking correctly, you're cheating something, I actually gained about 1 to 2 pounds during that time. Now, obviously, at 6'1", 185 pounds, fairly active, I'm in a huge deficit. I did not get cortisol tested. I tried to get my thyroid tested, and the blood test got hemolyzed. Something happened, so they didn't get the results, unfortunately. But yeah, gained about 1 to 2 pounds. And that was just mind blowing to me. And I don't know if you've ever, you know, had clients that you've taken to like really extremes and seen that. And again, I want to emphasize, I'm in no way saying I wasn't in a deficit or anything, but I assume it must have just been the response of stress and gaining water. So this last day or two, I've actually even just like cut out some sodium just to see what would happen. And it's just been interesting. So I kind of want to hear your perspective on that, if you've ever dealt with that, especially if somebody's got a contest. Because at least for me, I don't have a contest, but if I did, the stress would be 10 times more, because it's now it's like, wow, I'm not hitting that goal when it really matters.
Well, if someone had a contest, I probably wouldn't have done that in the
Final
first place.
stages, yeah. Well, at
Yeah.
all, maybe.
Well, probably not at all, because it sounds like you're trying to reach a weight target. Like even though you're adding in veggies, the food bulk was something like you were trying to make the weight go down despite that.
Yeah, I mean, kind of. I wanted to hit, I had in my head a depleted 178, so like a real 180, just because I know, like, for me, that would be very lean. So it was more just the realization that once I added the food bulk, I was like, oh, I actually am heavier. And then with that food bulk comes some bloat. Like, I was really not bloated at all on carnivore. So even just adding vegetables, there was some sort of bloated response that made me look higher body fat. And that realization that, oh, yeah, I was doing carnivore, which I'd never done before, I must have actually not lost as much weight as I thought.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think some of that is like when you go from a very, very extreme restricted diet to another, there's going to be some changes in the way you look that I'm not even going to try to explain because I don't necessarily know why, but that take a while to settle. So like, for example, if I was coaching someone in your scenario, I think there was a number of decisions you made, like to try carnivore, which is, you know, I understand it's experimental, that the overcorrection in response to those initial decisions are probably not ones I would have made. Like,
right.
Sure. You look a little blurry. You haven't had vegetables for a month. Let's just let's step off the scale and just stick to what we know is absolutely going to be a deficit for you and not worry about it.
Yeah.
And I think when someone gets really hyper-focused on the scale as well, I often do take time off the scale. I think that's helpful. And then my first thought is to give someone a diet break when they're seeing weird body weight changes in response to that, because it just means they're retaining a ton of water. They're probably constipated. Yeah. And there's a lot of food bulk that's hanging around and stress that's accumulating, and it's more counterproductive and helpful to keep them weighing. So... yeah, I've absolutely seen it. A lot of the times when you're pushing low calories and the body weight's doing funky stuff, the only times I'm pushing low calories with clients is when there is a deadline and they have to make it as far as, like, let's get as lean as we can in this time period. And sometimes, especially with the competitor, at that point, I'm not even looking at the scale. We're going, right, we're trying to achieve a certain level of leanness. There's probably a certain area or body part we're looking at. So, for example, during my contest prep last year, that period where I was on very low calories was in May. And it was only a 3 or 4 week period.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the diet, my calories were coming up and then eventually maintaining for like 8 weeks in maintenance. So during that period, we were just pretty much, Berto and I were just looking at my glutes and hamstrings, not much else. The scale did some weird stuff, didn't really care, and just kind of stayed focused on what are we trying to accomplish here. We're trying to get me into a position where we think, okay, when we bring up calories, it's only going to be looking better. We're not going to get this guy who's filled out, but not maybe as lean as he should have been. Mm-hmm. So we kind of saw it as like a investment phase into getting, you know, striated glutes, split hamstrings. And then when that happens, calories started coming up. And, you know, that can be a little bit of a different ball game when you're dealing with, say, like a weight class restricted strength athlete, like a powerlifter has to make weight. But then it's not even when you're that close and you have to reach a certain weight goal, you're not even manipulating calories necessarily. It's how long do we go without water or whatever.
Right. So, I think a few great points there. I mean, for one, definitely the overemphasis on weight is something to be said there. Again, I think for me, I kind of wanted to see what would happen with these things. And I don't think there's anything wrong with, like, for instance, going back to a guy, I would say these all make sense, right? Mm. It's more just seeing it for myself of like, oh yeah, you know, it probably didn't make sense that I lost 3 pounds doing, you know, a week or two of carnivore when my deficit wasn't that big. But it's kind of like at the moment you're like, oh, this is going so great. You know, just certain things, it makes sense after the fact. And then certainly I got impatient and I figured, you know, I'm so goal oriented that, like, if I say something's going to happen, like, it has to happen. Like, whatever it takes, whatever amount of effort, it needs to be done. So 1,000 calories for 2 weeks sounds horrible. But for me, it's like, I'm going to hit that goal. And so to then wake up, I mean, literally at one point, I was 3 pounds heavier after about a week at 1,000. I was like, how is this even possible? I mean, and again, I know how it's possible. It's just, it's bizarre to see it. So yeah, definitely an experience. And so tomorrow, but like my calipers still go down, especially my thigh calipers.
That's good.
I find that you'll hold water oftentimes where you hold fat. And so, like, you know, my abdominal skin folds didn't go down a lot, but thighs, I got like veins all over the place. And tomorrow will be my first refeed of more water, sodium and carbs. So I'll be taking some post-cut pictures that I think will look pretty cool. So that'll be good.
Also, make sure you let the calipers settle for a while, because they like in areas where you're retaining water, the water will kind of like
squish out,
compressing and squish out. So
yeah. I've always found with my chest and thigh, where it hits right away is about where it stays. And with my abs, it's just like,
yeah, it's like squeezing a sponge.
So one, I remember you mentioning there was a period of time, I think you had two contests, And you said you got really lean, and I don't think you tried to say contest lean, but you were trying to say quite lean. And you said that you felt pretty good as the calories came up for a while, but then the longer you tried to stay lean like that, you felt worse again. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, so we're actually kind of picking up on the story of so I did that period in May. I got into stage condition, and then like I said, my average was down around, geez, I think when if you actually look at my average in that last, it was 1600 calories. If you look at my refeeds, there was periods where it was 1400 for a week just because we pushed the refeeds back. So it's like delayed refeed. But if we look at my standard quote unquote setup during that period, it was low days and high days for an average of 16.
Just real quick, what was it was a refeed like once a week at low like maintenance or?
Normally they were 2 to 3 times per week, and then during that period, they were Birdo instituted. They were on a basically when I think you've made a lot of progress and you're looking a little beat up, too beat up, and training's not good or sleep's negatively affected, we'll throw one in. So they were kind of like these auto-regulated pit stops during that period of cutting. So anyway, once we hit a certain level of leanness that we wanted to achieve, that was in early June or late May, then calories just started coming up. They came up to an average of 1900, then 21, and then 23, and they just kept going up until I was basically hanging out at all times. I didn't have refeeds anymore. I was just between 2500 and 2800 calories on average. I competed in a show the first weekend in July, the third weekend in July, and then the second weekend in August. And by the one in August, I had been at maintenance for basically I'd done a reverse diet for 9 weeks, if you will. So the cool thing was about my prep is that I had experienced the traditional conservative reverse diet, like add 100 calories a week for 9 weeks, and saw myself just getting leaner and leaner and leaner,
That's
or
awesome.
appearing that way. I looked my best probably in late July because we had a bit of a I don't know, yeah, I guess I'm trying to think. My body just started not cooperating, like in right around the first week of August. Like I started, like when I on the day of the show, I had a very conservative carb load because again, I was walking around with 2,500, 2,800 calories, and like I got like a little bloaty and ankle edema, and my quad started blurring, and I was like, that's kind of weird. Like I've always had is like a few sushi rolls, you know. But I had, you know, I flew the week before. I was traveling all over the world. I presented in Melbourne, the UK, and I was in California for 3 weeks for those shows, all within a couple month period. So I didn't go more than 3 weeks after I started bringing calories up without traveling across like 5 time zones. So I was doing that, and I was, you know, I had a lot going on. We had I was basically living my life as though I was not competing, which I'm really proud that I could do that. But I think the toll happens somewhere, you know, when you're shredded and only sleep 4 hours before you pop up and have to find a way to fall back asleep and stuff like that. So, so obviously the worst I felt for the whole diet was during that period of being on like 1600 calories. That was just brutal, you know, because I'd already done a show. I competed in April and then May. I went from lines in my glutes to like fully striated glutes in May. So I was already lean and then decided, let's eat nothing. So being shredded and on low calories is the worst combination. Either one of the others by themselves is not too bad. You know, if you have a fair amount of body fat, you just don't feel too shitty. Or if you're shredded but you're eating a lot, you don't feel too shitty, which is basically what your question was. So the comparison of being on 1600 to 1900, 21, 23, 24, 25 calorie, I was feeling better and better and better compared to that low point. But if we compared me to some point in, let's say, early April before my first show, where I wasn't that much less lean, but there is certainly this tipping point when you go from maybe what the internet would call 7 or 8% body fat for a male to what the internet would call 5 to 6% body fat for a male, it feels substantially different. When I was on a refeed day in March or early April, I almost felt like off-season normal levels. I wasn't food focused. I was fine. Those nights I would sleep better. But certain things just would not get fixed, no matter how high I brought my food up, until honestly, a couple months post show, post final show. We're talking like in like November, December is when I felt approaching normal again. So yeah, I brought my food all the way up, and I was still couldn't sleep through the night. Still had pretty much no libido, and my strength started to dip after holding steady and even increasing early in prep. Sometime in mid July, my strength started to drop off just a little bit.
Even with the increasing calories.
Oh yeah. Yep.
That's interesting. Did you notice an initial boost in strength when you went from like the 1600 average going up, or did it just kind of maintain and then eventually start dropping?
No, I noticed more that the workouts just were not as hard. I didn't feel like I had to slog through them. I didn't have to cut volume as much. I didn't feel like I needed deloads as frequently.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. So I have seen very rarely anybody actually try to stay like near contest condition. I have an acquaintance who he's probably, in my opinion, about 10 pounds above contest condition, but he stays pretty lean year round. I mean, he kind of followed the traditional path, bulking up a lot over the years. And now he's, you know, he's a very lean 145 at like 5'5", and he just kind of lives his life like that. And what he found was that when he had reverse dieted up to about 3000, but still staying lean, he said that he just never felt satiated. You know, he was always just craving more. But what he does now, which again is, I wouldn't say unheard of, but definitely more unusual, is he will have, like, let's say his baseline's 145. He'll have a refeed day that might be 4,500 calories. So that'll spike him up to 148. And then he'll have 2 to 3 days at low, like maybe 1800. And when he gets back to baseline, he will refeed again. And he says that he finds this more enjoyable, kind of a more fun way to do it, and that he is satiated every, you know, 3 days. I assume on his low days, he's just eating the healthier, you know, more filling foods. And it's something that I planned on kind of toying around with, just because I don't know if it would be, I think it would be fine to gain. I mean, actually, in this time, he has gained quite a bit of strength, even though he had already been lifting for about 10 plus years at that point. He said he hasn't gained that much size, but, you know, if you're maintaining the exact same weight, I wouldn't really expect it. So I don't know if you ever really either played around with that yourself or heard of people trying to do this, just kind of like, it's almost like a carb cycling method, but basically refeeds every 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, I kind of did something like that in 2011. I eventually just got tired of, after my competition, I just got tired of being food focused and reminding myself that my goal is to build muscle, not to, you know, like look good for no one, who cares. And and I started like this being really excited every time one of my refeeds came around, and I'm like, this is stupid. Like, I live in a first world country in 2011, and my favorite part of the week is getting to eat bagels. Like, this is dumb. Yeah. Like, I'm being this is borderline eating disorder. Like, why am I doing this, you know? So I just saw no reason to live my life like that, and I reminded myself, like, my goal is not to look aesthetic. You know, I'm a competitive bodybuilder. This is
right.
I'm not trying to please anybody. And being lean's okay, but it's like it's nothing special.
Yeah.
And I think that was kind of my like. I eventually I looked up one day, and I think I said in one of our 3DMJ meetings, like, I'm not doing the carb cycling thing anymore, guys. Like, I can stay lean. I can keep doing this. And but it's just not working. Like, I'm not gaining lean muscle mass. It's,
yeah.
It's like better than dieting, but a lot of things are way better than dieting. And I think a good way of just looking at it is, you know, the whole cascade of physiological responses to having low energy availability are all interconnected, right? Mm-hmm. Which is helpful. So for example, just the same way that a woman who is menstruating knows that if she is not menstruating or if it becomes irregular, that's a nice little thermometer on, oh, I have low energy availability, if it's related to, you know, dieting or athletic amenorrhea. That once that returns, it's a decent proxy for saying, oh, you know, thyroid's probably responding normally. My estrogen and testosterone levels are probably normal. Same thing, even with food focus. Like, if you are not satiated from eating, or you have to eat like 4,500 calories or 4,800 calories to feel satiated, you can probably bet your testosterone's low. Your free test isn't very good. Mm. All the rest of those things are not very high quality. Your sleep quality might be off too, or maybe not. Or maybe you have to take melatonin and do all like these gymnastics just to get a good night's sleep. Like, none of that's ideal for an athlete or someone who is serious about building muscle. So until that is all back to normal and you don't have any subjective symptoms, then I think you're doing your body a, I mean, you're just making a sacrifice, you know, and it's suboptimal for sure. So I think the way I look at it is, you know, what are your goals? Where do you want to be? And, you know, if you are finding ways to, like, if you found a cool trick to deal with symptoms, then you're still having symptoms. You just found a way to work around it, you know? So,
yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, you're acknowledging that it's maybe not like the best for muscle growth. And I think his argument there would probably be that he feels, at least, that as a natural for, you know, 12 years or whatever it is now, that he's kind of like, he doesn't compete anymore. He had in the past, but his whole thing is like, you know, we all got into this to look good, and this is my way of looking good year round. Whereas I think you, Eric, you have still these goals of competing, and you find that your competitive goals would benefit from the calorie surplus. I think for him, it's more like, I want to stay lean, and it's this refeed method is helping it compared to, let's say, 3,000 every day. But I'm glad you mentioned like the food focus and everything too, because that's kind of something that I've been thinking about a little bit more recently. And, you know, feel free to tell me if you think this is maybe a sign of disordered eating, because I think it could be, but just knowing myself, I'm actually okay with it and for the time being. So basically, when dieting down, like we've all experienced at the start of the diet, I mean, I couldn't wait to diet because I was like force feeding my way up there. And I do have significant GI issues. So for me, like right away, I just noticed a big benefit. As I got down to about 186, 187, I found that I was still feeling pretty good and thinking like, well, maybe I could even go down to 175. Like that would be ridiculous. And then quickly after I started doing the more extreme stuff, not surprisingly, that desire pretty quickly went out the window and I just wanted to be done with it. Again, not surprising. But I do find that, you know, obviously we would say it's too extreme to say like food is only fuel, you know, but then there's other people who food is their whole life and there's hopefully a balance. Mm-hmm. The way I look at it is like, you know, on Thanksgiving, we don't have 300 million Americans don't have an eating disorder, right? We all think about food. We all look forward to food. Half the country binges, but we wouldn't say there's an eating disorder. It's just there's a time and place when food is fun or is a source of enjoyment, right, in a way that's maybe more than what would normally be done. And I kind of looked at that refeed method of, well, would I do that forever? Maybe not. I think as my body fat got higher, I would frankly just care less. You know, something I said to Abel as well, we chat quite a bit during this dieting phase, was that there are things that it's amusing to step back and think about it, where while dieting, I think, wow, when I'm done dieting, I could incorporate, like, there's a Qdoba across the street. I could have that daily if I wanted. And, like, when bulking, there's a reason I don't do that. Because why would I spend $10 at Qdoba every day? It just doesn't, like, and but, like, who would care to do that? But when
you're dieting, not food motivated at that point, yeah.
Exactly. But it is funny, regardless of how many times we do it and diet down, those thoughts still come, and you just kind of learn that, like, this is normal process, which is freeing in a way. You know that this is normal and it doesn't just take over. But in any case, I was thinking that, like, to some degree, I'm okay with a period of, you know, a month or whatever it is where I have these refeeds and in a way, like, do make food fun for that time being, where, you know, twice a week I'm going to have refeeds and that might be 4,000 or 5,000 calories. And I'm not going to crash diet afterwards, but maybe the other days are, let's say, 2,000. And I don't know. I guess I just didn't see it as a negative. I recognize that it puts a lot of focus on the food. I just don't know if I see that as like this like huge problem where I would need to, you know, talk to somebody about my eating disorder, but maybe you have a different perspective.
Oh, no, I don't have a different perspective. To clarify, you know, I understood your question as answering it about how I've tried it and how I found it, not a judgment about it for other people or, you know, that your friend who does it. I stopped doing it because I didn't like it.
Yeah.
That simple, you know?
Okay.
I think it was counterproductive to, or I mean, not counterproductive. It was suboptimal for what my goals are. And, you know, I'm not huge on like, hey, you got to find a time to be in a surplus necessarily. I think you can make a lot of work done in a pretty, very small surplus. But at the same time, I'm also like, I think I think this whole thing is a lot more fun. You know, we do this to look good, right? But I think a lot of people, they just try to get just a little too close to the sun. You know, like they try to be, they're trying to look as lean as they want to look rather than in partnership with their body. What's the leanest I can be without having any of these issues? Yep. You know, I can't tell you how many times people have come to me and they're like, you know, maybe they can sustain it for a couple of years. They're hanging around 8%, 10% body fat or something like that. But it eventually starts causing problems in other ways, you know? And it's just, it might be as simple as just being annoying, this thing they have to do all the time.
Sure.
It can be much more drastic than that, depending on not only just how educated they are and how experienced they are with manipulating their food, but also how kind of neurotic they are. Mm-hmm. You know, if they've got two of those 1800 calorie days in a row and it happens to be when their significant other or family member wants to go out to eat and they're tracking the calories and they have a fight, and like all that's because they want to be 10% instead of 12%, you know? Right. So, I mean, I have no problem. People can do whatever the hell they want. I just think if you are keeping yourself in a state of low energy availability and having, you know, hormonal and sleep and libido consequences to some degree, that's not something I want to do,
sure,
regardless if I was competing or not. But if that's something that other people are comfortable with, and you know, if I was their coach, I would probably ask them if they had people around them who were comfortable with it as well.
Right.
But it's
right.
their life. So I mean, I have no issue with that. I mean, there's that what is that borderline eating disorder saying? Like, nothing tastes as good as being lean feels. Like when I hear that, I'm like, somebody hasn't been that lean for that long,
right?
Is really deep in the grips of being obsessed with having a vein visible that normally shouldn't be,
right?
So, I don't know. I guess I think I don't want to sound judgmental, but a lot of the times when I run into people who create acrobatics in their life to be really what is normally unsustainably lean, like, you know, close to contest condition we're talking about, my first thought is, man, like, do they have other ways to see self-value and self-worth and like human connection and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. And some people are just are lean, you know, like,
sure.
The more time I've spent living the bodybuilding lifestyle, like, if you look at, I've technically done bodybuilding wrong. Like, I started my first contest prep, I started at 215, I started my second contest prep season at 200, and I started this last season, I missed one there, I'd started at 215, 210, 200, and this last time I started at 195, you know? So you can see that I'm getting better and better and better at doing this whole off-season thing, and making progress, if you look at each one of those years as well, when I get on stage, at keeping things in a more, I don't want to say keep it tight, but my body fat doesn't get as high in the off season,
sure,
and my walk around weight is leaner and more muscular. So I look better over time.
Yeah.
I think the old school problem was that people would just like bulk cut. And they would go from looking like that hilarious picture of Lee Priest opening the door with looking pregnant to, you know, the awesome Lee Priest on stage or their personal equivalent of that. And that's not great either, because you don't know what maintenance looks like ever.
Yeah.
It's always, a bulk and then a cut. But
what did you
I think
in your last one, was it like 176 or you not drop that low?
Yeah, I got to 80 kilos. So that was my lowest weigh in, somewhere right around there. The only other thing I would say is, Americans don't binge at Thanksgiving. They eat a lot on purpose because it's fun, it's enjoyable, and that's what they do, and it's intentional. I think, importantly, binge eating is when the food is being eaten, but you don't necessarily feel like you have agency in whether you do or don't anymore. And I would say the person who is eating 4,500 calories is not binging either. You know, that's an intentional plan. They're carrying it out.
Right.
So I would classify that as binge eating disorder. I don't think it's necessarily disordered eating, but I think you could be keeping yourself in a status that is objectively less healthy, or at least not fun symptomatically, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like the body can't operate in a status of low energy availability. It's just not fun.
Yeah, so. I mean, I definitely tend to agree with you. I mean, I too, you know, the heaviest I got up to was about 220. And this last time I only pushed myself up to 205. And part of it is I literally don't even think my GI could handle as much anymore. But I find that, you know, one of the things I said is I'm tired of being either overly full or starving 80% of the year. You know, it's just like at this point between 180 and 195 all look pretty good on me. One's just a little leaner and one's just a little, you know, softer, but bulked up, depending on if I have clothes on or not, but they all look good. They're all fine. And I don't really see much of a benefit in, you know, doing these like huge swings anymore. Cause I did that. My last one was like, okay, all out. This is going to be over a 2-year cycle instead. Gained 40 pounds, dieted down, netted maybe half a pound. And I was like, after that, I was like, that wasn't really worth it. So it's actually more enjoyable like this way. I feel like because I look pretty good most of the year. And like you said, there's a pretty clear distinction between where your body, again, I don't want to say like a set point, but there's a level where like at 190, I just feel like I can eat whatever I want. And obviously whatever I want isn't tons of food, but it's just what's comfortable for me. Yeah. And like 183 might be that like I'm constantly thinking about it. And I just so much rather live my life and be productive at that 190 that's 2% higher body fat than, you know, a little bit leaner that almost nobody's going to see anyway.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. Like I love that thing. Like, because the same thing is true for me when I get in the, oh, I would say like 198 to 210 range. Like for me, like, you progressively care less about food and you can eat whatever you want. But the thing is, whatever you want, it isn't like the same things you would want at like, for me, 190. What I would want is a surplus. You know?
Yeah,
like,
right.
So it's kind of this catch 22. To eat whatever you want, you have to get to a point where what you currently want is not what you want. You know?
Yeah.
So,
Yeah. The psychology of it all is very interesting. You know, your mindset about it. And there is something I wanted to mention. So I heard you on the, was it RTS podcast with Mike Teixeira, and this was, I don't know when it was put out. I only heard it in like the last couple of weeks, but it was a lot about mindset, which to me, I think, you know, most people probably who are even listening, they like to hear, you know, how can we cut most effectively? How can we do all these things optimally? But as you know, you obviously well know that a lot of that doesn't matter if you don't have a good why and you're not going to stick around for the long term. And you talked about how you kind of had this like warrior story in your head of, you know, why you do this and how you have to, you started to care about new goals as you could no longer do some of the things you used to. And I think that that's really important, but I also wanted to ask the tough question of, do you feel at times that some of that is backwards rationalization in terms of a justification for no longer being able to pursue it? And again, we all do this as humans, but it's like, you know, if you applied to med school and you didn't get in, oh, well, you know, I'm glad I didn't go because of X, right? And so I just, again, it's maybe like a more uncomfortable question, but how much of that do you think is just having to accept that, well, I can't pursue this goal that I really have, so I'm going to find a way to like this secondary goal?
Yeah, no, that's not an uncomfortable question at all, because it's something I even said in that podcast. I was like, you know, some to some degree, it could be, because I think the question Mike asked me was, you know, it seems like you have this intentional ability to change your motivation to keep you striving towards your goals, while other people maybe feel like they're a victim to it. And I said, well, hey, like, let's not put me in Superman category right now. I don't know how much of this is actually, I have agency in being very self-aware and changing the way I view the iron game, or I'm backward rationalizing because I don't have a 700 kilo total in powerlifting like I would love to have, you know. Another way to look at it, though, is that I think everyone has to adjust their goals because we don't make endless progress, you know. You either get hurt, injured, or can't get stronger anymore, or you get old, or you burn out. Like that's actually the outcome for everyone. The question is, what peak do you hit before that point? And is it something you are satisfied with? And the answer for most people is no, even world champions, you know, because then they stopped being a world champion. They got hurt. They wanted to defend it another year. They didn't hit this milestone. And the thing is, like, the milestones always exist. You know, like, we got a, you know, like, Eddie Hall's record just got broken,
right?
Maybe, depending on who you're talking
to. Yeah,
yeah. The 501 kilo deadlift. So I think we set these quantitative goals or these definable goals as is motivational fuel, but I think we need to have kind of almost an overarching story arc as what we're trying to accomplish. And I think that you could look at it as it's a backward rationalization, or you could look at it as I have a story arc that is more important than these objective small-term goals. Because if I don't, I'm guaranteed to be unsatisfied, because everyone either gets old, gets hurt, quits, burns out, something. There's unfortunately, we all die, you know? So I think for me, the way I when I realized that, I was like, okay, cool. So this is a physical culture journey. This is an Iron Game journey. I'm trying to make myself the best version of Eric Helms in terms of what's the most, you know, the most expression of lifting weights and the best physique I can get. But I still have those quantitative goals. But I also only set goals to the limits of what I know is reasonable. And if they don't happen, it's just like, well, maybe it wasn't reasonable. So like one of my goals, for example, is to get my WNBF pro card and compete and qualify, and sorry, place in the top five or the top half, I think is the rules, in a pro show, and then compete in Worlds. And, you know, that's kind of like I've always wanted to get dunked on by Jordan. I know I'm not going to be Michael Jordan in the NBA, but if any category of the Iron Game I actually am, you know, NBA quality, it might be natural bodybuilding.
Yeah.
I'm a mediocre powerlifter. I'm barely qualifying as someone who can call himself an Olympic lifter. Strongman, I'm okay at stones and decent at like two events, but unless someone handcrafted the perfect you know, strongman competition, I'm probably never going to place in the top three there either. So the point is that improvement is something that I'm striving for. So creating a story arc that facilitates me not burning out early, getting hurt, or essentially having an early exit from the things I love, facilitates me moving forward. Is Olympic lifting with some accessory bodybuilding work the best way to get me to that WNBF pro showing? Probably not, but it's definitely not a backward step. You know, it's basically me saying I'm going to take the scenic route. I'm still going to try to get there. But if I don't take the scenic route, I don't know if I get there at all. I might be that car that needs an early pit stop. So absolutely, it is 100%. The answer is yes. How much of that is backward rationalization? Or not backward rationalization, but how much of that is me manipulating my goals so that I stay motivated? Oh, it absolutely is. I don't know if it's backward. It's probably forward rationalization. Me knowing, I would love to go to IPF Worlds. That may not happen unless I do it like for Masters 2 or something like that and just outlast everybody. So I don't know if that answers your question directly, but I think it helps people understand what I mean by that is that ultimately these specific quantitative competitive outcome-based goals can always be reset and can always disappoint us. And most likely, if you are to get to a high enough level or to achieve certain things, unless you're that one person, like I'm sure, like, you know, Ronnie Coleman probably feels pretty satisfied about his Olympia career, but he'll also tell you that he didn't enjoy it until after the fact when he kind of looked back. At the time, he was so engrossed in it. So I don't want to be the person who either achieves these goals but doesn't enjoy them, or every time I achieve them, I set another one, and eventually I set one I can't reach and then feel dissatisfied. So to combat that, I create a process and journey-oriented kind of story arc of what story am I trying to fulfill in my life? What do I want to look back on? What can I tell people or share with people or write a memoir? And I think of it from that perspective. And I think that more qualitative experience and getting to try and do all the things that I love and pursue the Iron Game in different ways is something that, I had trouble sleeping last night because I was thinking about snatching. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I've been lifting. I'm 37. And I've been lifting since I was 21. So I'm keeping the relationship fresh, my friend.
You know? Yeah. I
I did catch on that podcast you were talking about how there was an example of like, you know, doing things that, that you don't always do the things that you're supposed to do. And I think your one example was that you don't always floss. So I have to just tell you that as self-proclaimed dentist of the fitness industry, I did catch that. And I will be checking in at your next 6 months.
I need a message every day. I need you to be my
accountability
reminder. Yeah.
But yeah, man, that topic to me at this point is much more interesting to me than, I mean, I still, you know, I subscribe to Mass. I still read all like the research that I can on these details of like, you know, does this timing matter or whatever. But ultimately what you're talking about is just very interesting to me because it matters more in the long run. You know, I mean, I've had to adjust so many times from a 14-year-old who just wanted abs to frankly finding that I didn't really have the genetics for what, and getting blown past by my friends and everything. And then, you know, getting into more of like the strength aspect and then running into pretty significant health issues. And that, I mean, completely changed how I had to view all this. And then coaching people myself and the podcast and now looking at this as like a journey, there have been so many changes that have come, you know, across that whole 15 years that I can't imagine when I look at like all my friends who are no longer doing it, I can't imagine staying with it for life if I didn't have some journey in my head like you talk about that you're enjoying the process. And like you said, hopefully not looking, because I've had an experience, not obviously like Ronnie Coleman, but like where I'll look back at different periods and think, oh man, that college lifting was so fun. And I'll think, was I enjoying it as much as like the rosy retrospection I have of it now, was I enjoying it or was I just stressed out about it at that time? And I don't want my whole life to be like that, where it's always nice in, you know, retrospect, but not in the moment. And so now, even like this morning, I was so tired and I'm so like lethargic and food focused right now, but I'm still thinking like, I'm so grateful that I can do this, that I'm like, I'm not currently in pain. I'm ambulatory, and that I'm able to have this journey that so many people can't or just never do, you know? So I think the perspective there is huge.
I can't, you said it really, really well, man. It's the question is, what do I need to do to have each one of those epochs or eras of my lifting be nostalgia worthy, but also be present while it's happening?
Yeah.
And man, nothing's harder. You think trying to get a 500-pound squat is hard. Try being present and appreciating everything you're doing while still being motivated to achieve more, but not feeling guilty or super disappointed when you don't all at the same time. I think that's a challenge. You know, you have to really dig deep, and you have to think about, why do I do this? What gets me excited about it? Where do I want to go? And then you, in that process, you'll probably want to rethink some things. And to be clear, there's also nothing wrong with stopping. You know, I do think it's probably healthy and beneficial for most people to stay physically active their whole life, but it doesn't have to be the iron game. You know, I've met people who retired from a peak in Olympic weightlifting, and this is, you know, a sport, most sports, the peaks happen really early, you know,
like
a gymnast, like, oh, you're in your 20s, you're washed up, you know, But an Olympic weightlifter, it's certainly earlier than a powerlifter. It's definitely earlier than a bodybuilder. You know, there will be a point where you have already reached the summit and looked out going, oh, wow, this is it. And maybe you don't realize it until you start to notice that, man, it's been a long time since I hit a PR. I'm coming down, or this is, I'm not going to be better than I was. Right. And I think it's okay to retire if it's on your terms, you're happy with what you accomplished. That story chapter is over, and then you start a new one. And it may be running, it may be CrossFit, it may be boxing, it may just be training for more process-oriented goals, or training because I enjoy it and it's something that keeps me in a good mind state and I can stay motivated with that, but now I'm focused more on my career or my family or something like that. So I mean, one thing I don't want to give the impression of, I'd like to give people insight into a new way of viewing the iron game so that it's not just this competition of how do I get better blank than my college buddies or myself from yesterday forever, and kind of just ignoring the fact that we age.
Yeah.
You know, to open up a new perspective on what the iron game could be for someone. But also, I'm not trying to say, and by the way, I've got it figured out and this is right. The only thing I can say is I'm on a journey. I've been enjoying it. It's a really cool thing. It's different than the way I used to view it, which was a little more quote-unquote traditional, which had problems. But I'm still going to age get weaker and have all the same issues, but I at least have a way to deal with it.
Yeah. Right, for sure. Well, man, I love talking about that topic. I have other questions, but I want to be respectful of your time. I'm sure this will not be the last time I have you on the podcast and that we'll be talking. So we'll cut it off here. And where can people find more of your stuff?
Well, let me just say, honored to be on for the 100th episode. I will always be happy to be back on, my man. And yeah, if anyone's curious about my stuff, speaking of the journey, you can find most of it at 3dmusclejourney.com. And there are links to my books, Mass, which you mentioned, thank you, and links to our blogs, our podcast. The other podcast that I have with Omar Yusuf, Iron Culture, it's available on most platforms. And then, of course, you can find my daily content at Helms3DMJ on Instagram.
Awesome. And yeah, I always love what 3DMJ is doing. You guys have kind of stayed true to your vision and everything. And I think people really appreciate that. So thank you again, Eric, for coming on.
My pleasure.